Most microbial evolution experiments do not involve gene exchange. In fact, gene exchange typically is excluded from these experiments because it's a complication. This creates a situation where the degree of evolution that can occur in the laboratory can pale to a large degree to what you can see in the wild. Of course, in the wild, you have huge volumes, you have large amounts of time, you have great heterogeneity, but you also have this potential for seemingly good species that you would expect to not be exchanging genes between each other, to in fact be exchanging genes among microbial organisms. And as a consequence, microbes have a flexibility in their evolution that can be rather dramatic, particularly in comparison to the degree of flexibility that we're used to when thinking about, for example, the evolution of modern animals. So this chapter creates kind of a bookend to the previous chapter in completing the introduction to what microorganisms and microbial evolution is all about in talking about gene exchange. Okay, so gene exchange. So just to remind you what a prophage is. So here's a prophage, presumably phage lambda. It's infecting a cell. It can either go into a productive cycle, here a lytic cycle, or instead into a lysogenic cycle. If it's a lysogenic cycle, in the case of phage lambda, and probably most phages that are temperate, the prophage forms by insertion into the chromosome of the host. That's shown right here. And thus the prophage serves as what essentially is a large gene complex found within the chromosome of the host. The replication of the prophage occurs in association with the replication of the host chromosome, which is what we're seeing right here. And thus there is a strong linkage between the reproduction, between the fates of the prophage and the bacterium that it's inhabiting. On the other hand, prophages, because they are phages, and they're capable of displaying productive cycles even following the formation of a lysogen, the process known as induction converts the prophage into a productive phage and a productive phage infection, and thus you see production of phage progeny and ultimately, in this case, destruction of the bacterial host cell and continuation of the phage life cycle. So lysogenic cycles involve the formation of these prophages. These are essentially multi-gene complexes, many tens of thousands of base complexes, and there's this linkage between the fates of the bacterium and the prophage, because the prophage replicates in tandem at the same time, by the same manner as the bacterial cell, but ultimately that linkage can be separated by this induction process where the phage instead turns back into what essentially is a productive phage, and that production of new phages is done at the expense of the fitness of the host organism. And just this is one of my pet peeves. Only temperate phages are able to display lysogeny. They're not called lysogenic phages, they're called temperate phages. And so this is showing phage mosaicism. And what we have here is one, two, three, four phages. And the pink lines are showing places where the two phages, in fact, are similar to each other, basically similar to this phage here, which presumably is phage lambda. There it is, lambda. And actually, phage lambda is what we saw in the previous slide as well. And you see these regions of similarity, interspersed between them are regions of dissimilarity. And that's what mosaicism means. It means that this gene here, or complex of genes, has a different evolutionary history from these genes here. And when you have genes that have different evolutionary histories, the first thing you should think is that the differences in evolutionary histories are probably a consequence of horizontal gene transfer. And that's explicitly the explanation for the mosaicism in bacteriophages, such as these shown here, that the similarities are a consequence of past recombination events sense, where this phage here or its ancestor recombined with a phage such as this one or its ancestor, such that it acquired that region, that region, that region, and that large region there from this ancestor and all of the rest of these regions from some other ancestor. So note the equivalence of the concepts of heterologous recombination. Remember where there's this change in the amount of DNA that's present as a consequence of recombination. The idea of moron acquisition, where you're essentially gaining more DNA. And to some degree, also the generation of genomic mosaicism through DNA acquisition. So this recombination that it results in more DNA results in different DNA results in the recombination between two genomes such that there is a loss of phylogenetic congruity between the genes found in the same genome. These all occur as a consequence of processes that can be described such as in terms of heterologous recombination or moron acquisition, or simply the swapping out of one gene with a equivalent gene, a process known as orthologous replacement. Mosaicism can also occur due to homologous recombination. That's the process that is called orthologous replacement. And these ideas of mosaicism are not limited to phages. And so this is an example of two bacteria, Bacillus anthracis and Bacillus cereus. And when you're comparing their genomes, you can see that there are places where there are differences between the genomes. And these differences are a consequence either of the acquisition of prophages by these bacteria or the acquisition of some other DNA somehow that doesn't seem to be associated with a prophage, such as genomic islands. And these are regions of mosaicism within these bacteria. There are differences between the two bacteria that presumably are a consequence of horizontal gene transfer. It's possible to try to argue these differences as not being a consequence of horizontal gene transfer, where you start out with some genome that basically has all the genes that are present in both of the descendant species, and then each of the descendant species lost different genes from that genome, and thus you end up with differences that look like mosaicism but aren't due to horizontal gene transfer. And once upon a time, that was the explanation for why you saw mosaicism, or an important explanation. People did not, or were not yet willing to believe that sex was quite as pervasive as it is among bacteria. But today, when you see mosaicism, your first thought should always be that it's a consequence of horizontal gene transfer. If you see new DNA that's not present in some closely related species or strain, you should be imagining that DNA arrived into this strain by horizontal gene transfer, particularly if multiple strains lack that piece of DNA, but one strain in particular has that DNA. Alternatively, bacterial genomes can't get big forever, and so there are countering forces. There are deletions that are imposed by just mistakes during replication that result in loss of DNA. So there's this steady state where you have this constant influx of new DNA from horizontal gene transfer, as well as duplication of genes within the chromosome itself, and then loss of DNA due to these deletion events. And one argument for why there is a particularly effective deletion is that it's one way that bacteria can eliminate prophages from their genomes. And in fact, the reason why a bacterium would want to eliminate prophages from their genomes is because these prophages potentially can become induced, thereby separating their fate from that of the bacterium. And while the prophages always have that possibility, it means therefore that the prophages aren't necessarily fully cooperative with the bacterium. So the bacterium is well off not being fully cooperative with the prophage. And so the bacterium, at least in theory, have mechanisms that have some potential to eliminate prophages from their genomes. And so this is another example of bacterial mosaicism. So these are two E. coli strains. The red and the orange basically are products of horizontal gene transfer. You can see there's a lot of horizontal gene transfer that has resulted in the mosaicism in comparing these two strains of E. coli that has resulted in the divergence of these two strains of E. coli from each other. And at least some of these products of horizontal gene transfer can be described as these islands, these genomic islands, such as the pathogenicity island. And so looking a little closer, we see lots of these orange and red regions, so lots of mosaicism in comparing these two E. coli genomes. So it's important to not lose sight of the importance of natural selection in all of these sexual processes, particularly horizontal gene transfer. When you're looking at mosaicism, you are looking not just at the acquisition of genes, or DNA, but instead you're looking at the survival of those products of recombination, the ones that have stood the test of natural selection. So basically, there's a whole lot of variation that can be put into populations as a consequence of migration, as a consequence of horizontal gene transfer. But this, the products of the resulting recombination, most of them, the vast majority perhaps, don't survive. And that's one of the keys to thinking about how microorganisms interface with this whole horizontal gene transfer thing. Horizontal gene transfer is a great way of introducing genetic variation into populations. It's hugely important in shaping the evolution of many microbial populations, but most of the products of this recombination, in fact, don't survive. The reason why the bacteria and viruses and what have you can take advantage of the potential for horizontal gene transfer is that the cost to that associated with that lack of survival tends not to be high. There is a relatively low cost to participating in sex, in part because sex is not participated in very often. So when sex goes wrong, as it usually will go wrong, you result in not too much losses from a bacterial lineage. And it is nevertheless a great way of generating these wonderful combinations of functions of alleles within organisms, but the vast majority of the recombination events do not result in these wonderful combinations. But the ones that do survive, in fact, tend to be these wonderfully innovative combinations of alleles and functions. And this is the secret of a lot of bacterial evolution, that every now and then these bacteria are able to hit upon these new solutions to old problems that are a consequence of them acquiring DNA, genes from other organisms. So this is a little essay of sorts on these ideas. The large number of transferred genes we find in modern bacterial genomes, that is the mosaicism, has misled many researchers about the benefits of genetic exchange. Many of the transferred genes are obviously beneficial to their new hosts, and this is frequently interpreted as conclusive evidence that gene transfer must be adaptive. The foreign origin of many of these genes is firmly established, but the bacterial genomes that they are found in are unfortunately a very biased record of evolutionary processes. The problem, of course, is natural selection. Because natural selection eliminates almost all deleterious alleles, the genomes of modern organisms are the result of several billion years of evolutionary success stories with not a single failure represented. And that's basically a tautology. Failure would be defined as not being represented. But nevertheless, the failures are not there. We're not seeing them. In a way, the sequences we see are a type of anecdotal evidence. Each represents a unique event that has, against the odds, survived. So horizontal gene transfer plus natural selection, or maybe minus natural selection, the elimination of the failures in horizontal gene transfer, is what underlies Mosaicism. Mosaicism is the tip of the iceberg. The Mosaicism that we see is the tip of the iceberg in terms of products of recombination. It just happens to be the ones that happen to have survived, and most of the recombination events that survived have done so because they provide some selective benefit to their recipients, or at least are not selectively detrimental. So there's a huge amount of mosaicism out there. Roger Hendrix et al. Really brought this to everybody's attention in the late 1990s, with basically comparing sequences of various phages and finding that, again, there's a huge amount of mosaicism. Here we're showing where different genes have come, are shared basically in terms of show homology between different phage types. And so you have lambda that's sharing all of these different genes with this phi flu, and sharing all of these just different genes with this phi C31, and sharing these genes with L5, and this gene with phi RV1 and phi RV2. Anyway, huge amount of mosaicism seen among phage genomes. And this is in part because phages tend to be highly recombinogenic in the course of their infections, and they produce large numbers of individuals. So the cost of mistakes in terms of recombination are not high. And also there's just a lot of phage infections that are going on out there, and so there's just a lot of potential for generation of recombinant phage products of recombination between two different phages. And this gives rise to a huge amount of mosaicism in the phage genomes, particularly the genomes of these tailed phages. A fair amount of the mosaicism that's found in these phages can be described as acquisition of these morons, more DNA. Basically, you have a phage genome, and it acquires via illegitimate recombination, heterologous recombination, a new section of DNA. And so thus you have the genome with its original genes plus some additional. Now, if in fact that combination of genes results in an increase in the fitness of the resulting phage, then you may in fact see persistence of that phage. And now you've got a phage with, say, N plus one genes, and you could have perhaps acquisition of additional genes. Now, this can't go on forever because the phage genomes are somewhat limited in their size because of the size of the capsids that the genomes have to be fit into. So the phages can't keep acquiring genes without increasing the size of their capsids. And so if the phage genome size is to remain constant, there must be corresponding losses of DNA in these genomes as well. There's some wiggle room. You don't have to have simultaneous gain and loss, but nevertheless, at some point, increases in number of genes are going to cause fitness decreases just because the genome's getting too big. And that can select for variants that, in fact, display spontaneous deletions of regions of chromosomes. Now, alternatively, this phage that has acquired this additional gene or genes, this additional DNA, it may not be displaying an increase in fitness, which is what is being shown down here, in which case you see a loss of the recombinant product from the population. So you have acquisition of genes, and those genes that increase fitness will tend to be retained. Those genes that don't increase fitness will tend to be lost. And you could argue that whole phage genomes built up over time as a consequence of this ongoing acquisition of new genes, such as from bacterial hosts that may, in certain circumstances, provided useful functions and therefore survived, the so-called moron accretion hypothesis. And again, more DNA morons, and this is due to non-homologous recombination, illegitimate recombination. So we've got outcrossing of some sort, some kind of sexual process. The first question is, Does the acquired genes or DNA or whatever, if it's an RNA virus, it'd be RNA, is this newly acquired nucleic acid even capable of persisting, even able to replicate? And if it doesn't replicate once it's been acquired, then it's simply lost from the population. That could be described as a segregation failure. It's natural selection against the acquired DNA. Alternatively, you have some kind of recombination. The newly acquired nucleic acid becomes in some way a part of the replicated genome of the receiving organism. But even in this case, the genes that are received may not contribute to an increase in fitness and therefore potentially will be lost due to natural selection, loss of the allele. And then we can continue onward. If indeed you do have acquisition of a new allele, if it provides a benefit, it may increase in frequency until the point that it displays a polymorphism within the population, or contributes to a polymorphism within the population. Alternatively, it may still be lost due to drift or natural selection, but it also may go on to fixation within the population, and thus essentially you have a fixation of a newly acquired gene or genes in a population of phages or bacteria or what have you. Okay, so what are the consequences of participating in sexual processes? So one of them is the biological species concept, the idea of maintenance of species cohesivity, genetic cohesivity, as a consequence of basically the exchanging of DNA with some individuals rather than, and not with other individuals. So with obligately sexual organisms, it's usually the individuals are reproducing only with individuals of the same species, and that isolates the species from other species. And you see something that's similar to that with, for example, bacteria, where there probably is a greater similarity among bacterial species than there otherwise would be as a consequence of the greater potential for a horizontal gene exchange within species of bacteria versus between different species. And specifically, this is with regard to the potential for incoming DNA to recombine homologously into the genomes of species that are of the same species, as well as the potential for this incoming DNA to not reduce the fitness of the recipient bacterium once it fa in fact has recombined into the genome of these bacteria. So, two, when you have sex, there is a loss of genotypes. Specifically, ones that already have stood the test of natural selection. So, as particularly obligately sexual organisms, every time they reproduce sexually, they're basically losing their genotypes. When you have children, you lose your genotype, or whatever your genotype is. It doesn't make it to the next generation. Your genes do, but your genotype doesn't because you're mixing that genotype with the genotype of your partner. And so this is not necessarily a good thing because you're losing those genotypes that, in fact, explicitly have stood the test of natural selection. You also have the breaking up of epistatic interactions, basically co-evolved genes. When you have sex, these genes can become separated from one another. And as a consequence of that, you have less potential for the coevolution of genes. Now, there's some compensation for that. Genes can be closely linked together, physically linked together, closely associated loci in bacteria and phages, for example. And that can reduce the potential for recombination to break up these linked genes, these epistatic interactions between different loci. But nevertheless, if sex is breaking apart genes, they've got less potential to co-evolve. Whereas in situations where sex is not breaking apart genes, they've got more potential to co-evolve. So sex in this case is also not a good thing. There also is a greater potential for within genome disharmony. The idea here is that a gene comes in and it either homologously or it recombines in, or it otherwise inserts into the genome that it's that's receiving it. And this gene may not play well with the other genes already present in the genome, and thus you have within-genome disharmony. This is seen explicitly when you have the acquisition of parasitic DNA, selfish DNA, that in fact, once it's inside of a genome, actually can reduce explicitly the fitness of the genome as a consequence of its intended actions, as opposed to just simply arriving in a genome and messing things up in non-specific ways. On the other hand, you have the potential for sex to break up epistatic interactions that are seen or can be found between co-evolved genes that in fact provide parasitic functions. So if you've got a parasitic piece of DNA, it can only be consist of so many genes before it's highly likely that recombination will separate the genes from one another, particularly in the course of meiosis. If the parasitic genes are found in one of the parents' genomes and not in the other, then in the course of meiosis, you might have the production of progeny chromosomes that do not have all of the parasitic genes, just thus, in a sense, inactivating the parasites. You also have the avoidance of Mueller's ratchet, because if you've got all the wild-type alleles and you have sexual processes going on, then you can bring all of those alleles potentially into the same individual, and thus you restore, if it's been lost as a consequence of genetic drift, the wild-type genotype within a population. You also have the potential you also have avoidance of basically periodic selection, and therefore the potential for purging of genetic variation from populations as a consequence of the fixing of a single genotype within the population. That's not the way that that natural selection works when you have sex. Natural selection, when you're having sex, fixes alleles, not entire genotypes. You also have the potential for, in fact, you'll have avoidance of clonal interference if you have sex. You'll increase the amount of variability in individuals each time you go through a round of sexual reproduction or sexual exchange at all, horizontal gene transfer. You're increasing the amount of genotype variability within a population. You can bring together alleles that have originated in different lineages. I've been saying how powerful sexual processes are in microorganisms as a way of increasing the amount of genetic variation within populations. And this is explicitly why it's powerful, because you've got alleles that have evolved in a different lineage, different organisms, and they can find their way into new organisms and thereby provide evolutionary innovations to those new organisms. Horizontal gene transfer plus illegitimate recombination also increases variability by providing new DNA that can provide new genes, new pathways, new genomic islands. And again, these are new pieces of DNA that become inserted into an organism's genome that provide new functions to the receiving organism. It's a rapid acquisition of new traits. Mutation takes forever to create new traits de novo. It also can take some time converting old traits into new traits, but if you can just acquire the new trait, either individual genes or whole pathways or whole collections of pathways in one fell swoop, then obviously evolution can occur much more rapidly. And you can also have increased rates of adaptation. That's due to this increased amount of genetic variation. Anytime that the rate of evolution is slowed by a failure for a population to have access to sufficient genetic variation, if you can increase the amount of genetic variation within the population, you have the potential to increase the rate of evolution. And the variation that can be supplied by horizontal gene transfer is not just random variation that might give you a benefit. You can actually have acquisition of, again, whole new processes. Although, At the same time, most of the acquired DNA is going to lead to recombinant products that are not terribly fit, just like you see with mutation. It's just that when the benefits arrive with horizontal gene transfer, the benefits can be rather spectacular in comparison to at least the amount of change that it can occur over short timescales due to mutation. And so this is just reminding us of what clonal interference is. One of the benefits of sex is that you don't have to have clonal interference. What clonal interference does, with sex, you can conceivably have the big A allele and the big B allele both be mutationally acquired in different lineages and then get together into the same lineage. With clonal interference, instead, the big A allele ends up competing with the big B allele, and as a consequence of that, you can have, in fact, extinction of beneficial alleles as you have the fixation of beneficial genotypes that happen to not carry those alleles. And then periodic selection. If you don't have sex, then you end up with individuals not sharing alleles. And when you get fixation, it's not fixation of individual alleles, it's fixation of individual genotypes. And in the process of this, you end up with extinction of alleles. So here we have fixation of the big A, little b genotype with loss of the little a allele. And in fact, here we, well, actually, I guess it's not complete loss because here we have I guess the little A allele has survived after all. Here we have the big A allele being lost as a consequence of fixation of the big B allele. Actually, part of what's going on here is that we had two mutations occurring. One happened out here and one happened right here. While there was still a substantial amount of little a allele around, the first mutation converted the little a to big A, and apparently that was beneficial, but the second mutation converted the little b to big B, and that apparently was even more beneficial, and thus the rise of the little a big B individual had the effect of driving the big A allele to extinction. But again, this doesn't happen when you have sex. When you have sex, you could conceivably end up with the big A and the big B allele in the same individual due to reasons other than due to mutation. So sex can put both alleles in the same organism. You don't end up with a loss of a beneficial allele when you have fixation of another beneficial allele, if in fact those two alleles can recombine into the same organism via sexual processes. So we then can turn to the question of why is it that bacteria in fact have sex? So it turns out that bacteria are much more promiscuous than eukaryotes are. They are willing to have sex with a far greater range of organisms, or alternatively, you can think of it as sex can be imposed upon them successfully with a far greater range of organisms. Bacterial mechanisms of recombination likely exist as a means of repair of DNA. This is the basic reason why bacteria and many other organisms have recombination processes. They serve as a way of dealing with particularly nasty lesions that have been acquired in their DNA. It's a way of repairing that DNA without actually losing the information associated with the DNA where the lesions are located. Bacteria outcrossing, although this is adaptive, bacteria outcrossing is not necessarily a function of bacterial adaptations. It can be a consequence of the action of bacteriophages. It can be a consequence of the action of phages imposed upon the bacteria. But in the case of transformation, even if it is a bacterial adaptation, it's not necessarily always an adaptation that's there for the sake of enhancing outcrossing. But instead, it might be a consequence of bacterial acquisition of, for example, food as a reason for why they are taking up DNA into their system. But then the DNA, once there, has some potential to recombine with the chromosome of the bacterium. Bacteria over long time scales, even if the the sex that they're having is not adaptive in the short term, over long time scales, it can indeed benefit the bacteria. They are indeed able to benefit from the acquisition of sequences of DNA from other bacterial species. The advantages of horizontal gene transfer or just sex in general, however, likely are not great enough in the short term to select for the maintenance of these various functions, at least in modern bacterial populations. So bacteria, for the most part, perhaps not 100%, but for the most part, are not willingly engaging in sexual processes and gene exchange and horizontal gene exchange. However, these processes are beneficial to the bacterial populations over long timescales, and because the costs of participating in these processes tends not to be terribly high on a per bacterium basis, the result is that bacteria can afford to be much more promiscuous in terms of the kinds of organisms they are having gene exchange with. Although you can think of it in a different way, if in fact sex is being imposed upon the bacteria rather than something they willingly participate in, they might not have much choice in terms of their promiscuity. It's whatever DNA manages to come in and then survives that ends up becoming incorporated into bacterial genomes. If obtaining substantial variation can justify being able to have sex, and this might be the case in terms of transformation, then we would assume that the advantage accrued by a ability to have sex allele would be equivalent to the advantages accrued by general mutator alleles. That is, in both cases, they're allowing for processes that more often than not lead to problems, but since they occasionally lead to advantages, the alleles that are responsible for these processes will benefit by hitchhiking on the genotypes that carry the beneficial alleles that they had a role in creating. So sexual genes in bacteria, if indeed they exist for any kind of advantage the bacteria in the short term can accrue, likely provide an advantage that's equivalent to that advantage provided by general mutator alleles. They are associated with bringing beneficial alleles into genomes, which can be good for them as well via genetic hitchhiking. So hitchhiking of sex alleles with acquired beneficial alleles could be an advantage to for bacteria for having sex alleles, to the extent, in fact, bacteria, through natural selection, have acquired alleles that contribute to their ability to have sex. So in summary, which of these transfer processes is more important of what we talked about? So there's transformation. It's probably quite important for naturally competent organisms, although it's probably limited in terms of what kind of genes are likely to become incorporated into the bacterial chromosome. Specialized transduction is probably important mostly if you define specialized transduction broadly to include morons. Conjugation, this is for a subset of functions such as antibiotic resistance. It's very relevant, although it may be less important in terms of its overall impact on bacterial evolution compared to generalized transduction, simply because generalized transduction can just bring in so much DNA at one time. These high-frequency recombination conjugation, is it just a laboratory artifact? My assumption is that probably is, although there might be situations in which it can contribute to bacterial evolution in the wild by allowing plasmids that have integrated into the host chromosome to, when the plasmid is transferred, to also for there to be some transfer of host chromosomal genes as well. And don't forget that host genes can recombine into plasmids, and thus host genes can be transferred in the course of plasmid acquisition by new bacteria. Generalized transduction, hugely versatile in terms of both the types and size of DNA that can be transferred, but it's mostly a stochastic process in terms of what DNA is transferred, so it may be less likely to result in selective benefits than conjugation. So conjugation, genes that are associated with the plasmids are there to a large extent because they increase the potential for the plasmid to survive once it has been transferred to a new bacterium, as well as survive over time within the bacteria they already exist in. And generalized transduction probably is much less likely to carry genes that are going to be beneficial to the recipient bacteria. On the other hand, when it does work, it can work spectacularly, for example, carrying whole genomic islands over into the receiving bacteria. And then you are what you eat is probably similar in its importance to generalized transduction, but only to those organisms that can participate. These would be the phagocytic eukaryotes, the protozoa that eat by phagocytizing other organisms. Although, as essentially a variation on you are what you eat, the acquisition of endosymbionts by mostly eukaryotes, but also by bacteria as well, can provide another source of DNA that essentially can find its way to the genome of the host organisms in a manner that's similar to what you see with you are what you eat. So the key take-home messages are these, of course, not the only messages, but the key ones. While mechanisms by which DNA is transferred as well as retained are important, what is particularly crucial is to what extent the DNA that is acquired provides a selective benefit. Since absent such benefit, it is unlikely to be retained within populations. And then lastly, linkage in its various forms drives the evolution of cooperation. And in subsequent chapters, these ideas are going to be a very relevant part of what we'll be talking about. But at this point, we've at least covered in some moderate detail what sex is all about, what its benefits are, what its potential costs are, particularly as this can occur within bacteria.